This coming week in Shul, this coming Shabbos, we'll be reading Parshas Zachor. And Parshas Zachor has an interesting mitzvah in it that I've always found a little bit troublesome. The mitzvah of Mechiyas Amalek, of wiping out the nation of Amalek. Now, I found it a little bit unusual because wiping out a nation is not the kind of thing that I would typically associate with Judaism. When I think about Judaism, I think about chesed, I think about tzedakah, I think about food, but I don't usually think about wiping out an entire nation. But if you look in the psukim of Parshas Zachor in Source 1, that's what the Torah is asking of us. Zachor et asher asalacha Amalek v'derech b'tzeischem mimitzrayim. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you were leaving Egypt. Asher korcha baderech v'yizanev v'cha hol hanecha shalim acharecha v'ata ayef v'yageya v'lo yare Elokim. That he happened upon you on the way, and he killed from among you the weak people who were lagging behind in the rear. And you were faint and exhausted, and he, Amalek, did not fear God. And here's the command. V'hayab v'haniach Hashem Elokecha l'chol mikol eivecha misaviv ba'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha notein l'cha nachala l'rishcha timche et zecher Amalek mitachat Hashemayim lo tishkach. And it shall be when Hashem your God gives you rest from all your enemies around you in the land that Hashem your God gives you as an inheritance to take possession of it, you shall wipe out the remembrance of Amalek from under the heavens. You shall not forget. So we have this mitzvah to wipe out the nation of Amalek. And it's so important, to add on to this question, it's so important that the Torah says that God's name and God's throne will not be complete until Amalek is wiped out. If you look in source number 3, there's a pasuk in Shmos that follows immediately after the first battle with Amalek. And it says, Vayomer ki yad al keska milchama l'Hashem ba'amalek midor dor. And he, Moshe, said, for there is a hand on the throne of God. Hashem maintains a war against Amalek from generation to generation. And Rashi asks a question on this pasuk. If you look, the language is a little bit interesting. The word for throne, case. Typically, the word for throne or for seat would be kisei, but it's missing an aleph. And if you look at the name of God, it uses the two-letter name of God, where typically in the Torah we more commonly see the four-letter name, yodkei vavkei. So Rashi answers, if you look in source number 4, where I underlined, why is there this shortened language of the word kisei and of the name of God? She'ein shmo shalem, ve'ein kiso shalem, ad she'yimcha shmo shal amalek kulo. Because the name of God and the throne of God will not be complete until Amalek is completely wiped out. Why? What's so important about wiping out this nation? And we've had a lot of enemies in the past. Why this specific Amalek is so integral to God's name, God's throne, that should be wiped out. And also considering our recent history, there's something that I find a little bit uncomfortable about the idea of wiping out an entire nation. So in order to answer these questions, you need to understand the first Mishnah of Pirkei Avot. If you look in source number 5, it might be something that you're already familiar with. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, umisara liYoshua, viYoshua liZkenim, uZkenim liNeviim, uNeviim masaruha laAnshe Knesset haGedola. And then it goes on to say what the Anshe Knesset haGedola says. So this Mishnah gives us a little bit of the narration of the transmission of the Torah from Moshe down to Anshe Knesset HaGedola, and then it continues on from there. I must have read this Mishnah 1,000 times, and I never noticed there is a glaring textual problem in it that the Maharal, in his commentary on Pirkei Avot, points out. If you look at it backwards, Anshe Knesset HaGedola, they got the Torah from the Nevi'im, from the prophets, and the Nevi'im got it from the Zakenim, the elders. Sounds good. Zakenim from Yehoshua. Makes sense. Yehoshua got it from Moshe. Okay. And Moshe got it from Sinai. But who did Moshe get the Torah from? Hashem. It should say Moshe kibel Torah me Hashem. What does it mean that he received it from Sinai? And the Maharal answers that the fact that Moshe received the Torah from Sinai is integral to the very essence of the Torah and the whole concept of receiving the Torah. If you look where I underlined, Kizem Moreh in source 6, Kizem Moreh al Ikar Malat HaKabbalah Shel Moshe, Shehaya HaKadosh Baruch Hu Miyached Lo Makom, Vehu Har Sinai, Latet Lo Sham Torah, Velo Haya HaDavar Bekeri. The fact that the Torah was set to be given at Sinai teaches us the essence of Moshe's receiving the Torah, that Hashem established a special place, and that place was Har Sinai, to give him the Torah, and there was no element of this giving that was bikari, that was happenstance, that was coincidence, that was random, that there was a very set giving. It comes to teach us there was an appointed place to get the Torah. Now, why is that so important? Well, think of an analogy. Let's say tomorrow, you're walking down the street and you run into a friend. And she says, oh my gosh, I'm so happy I ran into you. I have something so important that I have to give you. And she gives it to you. Let me ask you something. Is it so important? Is it really that important? No. Because if it was, she would have called you and she would have said, hi, I have something really important that I have to give you. Can we meet, let's say, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Starbucks, so that I can give it to you? The fact that you ran into her on the street and she happened to give it to you makes the fact that she gave this to you kind of a coincidence. And that's what needed to be avoided in the giving of the Torah. If you go down a few lines to where I underlined again, Ulekach amar Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, shaya miyached makom lekabala zot, velo haya kan kabala b'mikra klal. Therefore, it says Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, that there had been a place established for receiving it, and there was no coincidental receiving here at all. And why is it so important that the Torah should be given in a set way? Because that's what the Torah does. The Torah brings order to the world. That's the purpose of Torah and the message of Torah, that there's an order to the world, that God created the world, that God has a plan, that everything that happens in this world is part of God's plan. That's the message of Torah. And because that's a message of Torah, the Torah has to be given in a way that expresses this idea. It couldn't just be given kind of coincidentally and randomly. This idea that God controls the world, God created the world, that there is order and purpose to the world, B'nai Israel bring that koach into the world. The power of Emunah, the power of Kedusha, those are powers that B'nai Israel bring into this world, that we embody. But we also know there's a concept of Bechira in the world, of free choice. So for every good force in the world, positive force in the world, there has to be a negative counterforce. So if B'nai Israel bring in the force of Emunah into this world, there has to be something that brings in the opposite. And the Slonim Rebbe in Nisivo Shalom says that Amalek brings in this counterforce. Amalek is the anti-B'nai Israel. They introduce into the world doubt, question, lack of holiness, kfira, the questioning if God exists, if there is a plan. And you see this in the very words of Parsha Zachor. If you look back into that first source, it says, Asher korcha fadera, that Amalek happened upon you on the way, which is kind of an unusual language. If you look in Rashi in source 2, what does korcha mean? Lashon mikra, the language of coincidence, that it just happened. They happened upon you. And he also gives another explanation. If you look at the second underlined part, Lashon kor vachom. Korcha comes from the language of cold, like cold and hot, like car. And in what way does korcha mean cold? If continue on. Tzinencha v'hivshircha mirticha techa. שהיו אוהבי כוכבים יראים להילחם בכם, ובזה והתחיל והראה מקום לאחרים. משל למבטיה רותחת, שאין כל ביריה יכולה לרד בתוכה, בא בן בליעל אחד, קפץ וירד לתוכה, אף על פי שנכבה, הקרא אותה בפני אחרים. How did Amalek cool down Ben Israel? It cooled them down from their boiling heat. That after they left Egypt, all of the nations of the world were afraid to start up with them. Why? Because who starts up with a nation that so obviously has God running the show behind them? And every nation in the world saw that. They saw what happened in Egypt. They saw what happened with Kriyas Yamsuf. And they all saw that there's some greater godly plan going on here. And so nobody would be crazy enough to get involved. Nobody, except Amalek. Amalek started up, and in starting up a war with Bnei Israel, Amalek showed the way for other nations to do the same thing. Rashi brings a mashal to a boiling bathtub that no creature could possibly descend into it, and one no good bad guy comes in, jumps into the bathtub, and even though he's burnt, he's scalded, just like Amalek was defeated in this war, he's cooled down the water for everybody else. And he does it because Amalek creates doubt. Amalek, the power that Amalek brings into the world is doubt. And Amalek created doubt. Maybe this isn't such a godly thing after all. And if you think about the two explanations of Rashi, they're really, in a sense, the same thing. Because how does Amalek create doubt? Amalek creates doubt by saying, it's all mikra. It was all coincidence. God, what? Miracles? Whatever, some frogs came in. Miracles? There was a wind. A wind came in and parted the sea. There's no miracles here. And in doing that, they punctured kind of a hole in this whole idea that this was all godliness and created doubt in the nations of the world, that they then would also be willing to fight against Bnei Israel. And they didn't only create doubt in the nations of the world. They also created doubt within Bnei Israel. Rav Neventhal of the Old City says that Amalek's attack on Bnei Israel is what allowed for Chet HaEgel to happen. That if you think about it, how could Bnei Israel go from a point of seeing all the miracles in Egypt to worshiping idolatry about 6-7 weeks later? And the answer is because Amalek created doubt within them, that they too started to doubt whether or not God was really organizing everything. And that is their defining trait. It's the defining trait of Amalek is this idea of creating doubt by saying that everything is coincidence. And you can see that if you look in Source 9. You see that in the language of the Megillah. When Mordechai comes to tell Esther about Haman's decree, it says, "Vayeged lo Mordechai et kol asher karahu." And Mordechai told him, referring to Hatach, the intermediary between Mordechai and Esther, all that had happened. That same language of karahu. And Esther Rabba in Source 10 says, "Vayeged lo Mordechai et kol asher karahu amar la Hatach." Lech emorla ben bino shall karahu ba alechem hahu dichtiv asher korcha baderach. Go tell Esther that the grandson of the descendant of karahu is fighting against us. Karahu, just like the person who was korcha baderach that happened upon us. That's the essence of Amalek, this coincidental language, this idea of creating doubt. And you can also see that and that gematria, the numerical equivalent of Amalek, is equal to the numerical equivalent of the word safek, which is Hebrew for doubt. And not only does Amalek try to create doubt, but they specifically try to create doubt when there's points of potential in the world. If you look back in the language of Parshat Zachor, asher korcha baderech, they attacked you on the way. Where were they on the way to? They were on the way to Matan Torah, to receiving the Torah. Whenever Bnei Israel is on the way to doing something great, whenever they're on the way to achieving a real tikkun in the world, so a real correction in this world, that's when a malek comes in and attacks. They attack on the way to Matan Torah. They attack right before Bnei Israel enter Israel. They attack right before the building of the first Beis HaMikdash. And they attack at the time of the Purim story, which was before the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. Whenever there's this real potential for something great to happen, that's when this force of Amalek comes in to try to create doubt. So we can see that what we're talking about when destroying Amalek isn't so much a physical destruction of a biological person, it's destroying a concept. What needs to be destroyed is this idea that God doesn't control the world, that God didn't create the world, that there's no rhyme or reason in the world. That's what we needs to be destroyed. And you can see that it's not a physical destruction by looking at the Rambam in source 14. Source 11. The Rambam in Hilchot Malachim is discussing all the different laws involved in conquering Israel. And he says, if you look right underlined, Aval Shiva Amamim v'Amalek, Shelo Hishlimu, Ein Manichim Mehem Neshama. When it comes to fighting the seven nations of Canaan within Israel and Amalek, if they're not, if Shelo Hishlimu, when they do not agree to a peaceful settlement, and we know from elsewhere in the Rambam that a peaceful settlement includes accepting upon oneself the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide laws that all the non-Jewish people are required to keep. If they don't accept that upon themselves, then you're not supposed to leave alive a single soul. You have to kill out all of them, men, women, and children. And then he gives a proof text for that. But if you follow on that third line, Uminayin, she'eino medaber ella be'elu shelo hishlimu. But how do we know that this is only talking about those people who don't agree to a peaceful settlement? And he goes on to give a proof text for that. The command to wipe out Amalek only refers to those Amalekim who don't accept upon themselves the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Because what's contained in the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach? Belief in God and the basic laws for a stable, set society. Don't kill, don't steal, set up courts. Those are the requirements of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. And we know from looking at Amalek's behavior, that's precisely what they don't believe in. They don't believe in God, and they don't believe in an orderly society. For them, there's no right or wrong in society. There's no appropriate behavior. They attack Bnei Israel on the way out from Egypt for absolutely no reason. It is a complete wanton attack. There's no reason to attack them. They have no claim against them. Bnei Israel was no threat to them on any level. They weren't trying to take their land or pass through their land. They just attacked them for no reason and have no problem preying on the weakest members and killing them. They have no concept of murder. They have no concept of a fair society, and they have no belief in God. But if they agreed to those things, if they agreed to the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, then in a sense, they're not Amalek anymore. And if they're not Amalek anymore, because they don't embody this ideology of Amalek, then there's no reason to kill them. They don't warrant the death penalty, so to speak, that Amalek deserves. And you can even add to that this idea that it can't possibly be a physical destruction. Someone actually pointed this out to me last night, and I have to look into it a little further, but there is actually a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, that in Perek Dalet, pasuk Mem Gimel, that implies that Amalek was already destroyed in the time of Chizkiyahu, that Chizkiyahu finished off Amalek, in which case it would have to mean that we're talking about a spiritual concept, not an ideological concept that we're destroying, not a physical, biological entity. And now you can understand why it's necessary to remove the Amalek before Hashem's name and Hashem's throne can be Shalem. Because what's Amalek? Amalek's the idea that there is no God, and there is no God creating that created the world or that's controlling the world. And it's only when you remove that ideology from the world, when none of the nations of the world believe in it, that you can have the pasuk Bayom Hahu Yiyah Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. Only when this ideology is removed can God's name be one, and God Himself one, and His throne be one. If you look at Nechama Leibovitz in source 12, she states this beautifully: Amalek, against whom the Almighty declared eternal war, is not any more an ethnic or racial concept, but is the archetype of the wanton aggressor who smites the weak and defenseless in every generation. All the wonders and miracles of Egypt and Red Sea had come to publicize the omnipotence of God. Mankind as a whole might have taken one great step further and acknowledged the sovereignty of the God of justice and truth. But then along came Amalek, and unrestrained by the dread and awe that kept all the nations of the world in check, jumped, as it were, to use the midrashic figure, into the boiling cauldron and showed the way for others. Who was there to fear? That a people had gone forth from the land of Egypt? Who could prove that they'd been brought out by God? Had these not gone forth by their own power? Now they were wandering in the wilderness, weary and struggling. Why should they not be spoiled and smitten? This was the way of the world. And in this manner, the moment of awe at the mighty hand of God passed away, and the atmosphere of astonishment at His miracles evaporated. The world returned to its former rut, to its idols of gold and silver, its faith in mortal power and brute force. The opportunity had been lost. Who had been responsible? Amalek. For this reason, Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek midor dor. For this reason, Hashem has an eternal war with Amalek from generation to generation. This is the battle that Hashem is fighting with Amalek, and this is the battle that each one of us is fighting. If you look below in the Zohar, let us not think lightly of this war with Amalek. Verily, from the creation of the world until then, till the coming of the Messiah, there has been and will be no war like that, nor can even the war of Gog and Magog be compared with it. And this not because of the mighty armies taking part in it, but because it was launched against all the attributes of the Holy One, blessed be He. Amalek attacks against the very essence of God and the basic belief in that there is a God and that God is controlling the world. And that's something that we also have to fight, that we fight in ourselves every day, to look at the world and not feel that doubt, but to have the emunah that Hashem is running the show and that everything that happens in this world is part of God's plan. Now, what's the quintessential place that this battle of purpose versus coincidence is fought? At Purim. You could look at the Purim story and you could view it as a whole string of coincidences, or you could view it as God's hand. That's the challenge of the Purim story. Now, but why? Why is Purim the place where we fight this battle? And why are all the miracles of Purim hidden? Miracles of Pesach aren't hidden. Why are the miracles of Purim hidden? So to answer that, you have to look at source number 7, the Gemara in Yuma. In the interest of time, I'm just going to paraphrase it. We talked before about this idea of opposites, that for every force there is a counterforce. We know that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of three major sins: Avodah Zarah, idolatry; Gilui Ereyot, immoral sexual relationships; and Shfichut Damim, murder. After the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola asked God to remove the Yetzahara, the evil inclination for idolatry. It was too much. It's too much. It caused too much destruction. We can't fight against it. Please remove it. And their request was granted, and the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was removed. Then they went on, and they prayed to have the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Ereyot removed. And it was removed, but then they found that the world stopped. They couldn't find a chicken that had laid an egg. without the negative inclination towards immoral sexual relationships, there wasn't the positive inclination for sexual relationships, and nothing reproduced, and the world would come to an end. So they asked that that Yetzer Hara be put back. End of Gemara. So that's put back, but the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was still removed. So if that was removed, in order for there to be Bechira, choice in the world, there had to be a counterforce removed. And the counterforce that was removed was God's explicit presence in the world. When the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was removed, God's explicit presence was removed. Nevuah, prophecy, was removed. You have no more explicit miracles, obvious miracles, after that point. That all had to be removed. And there was a fundamental change in the world, which is why, if you think about it historically, that's the point in history where you have the rise of atheism. Up until that point, if you think about Greece, you have all these gods. You have the god of this, you have the god of that, the god of fire, the god of up, the god of down. And then suddenly, you have this new belief in atheism. Why? Was it because those people back there, oh, they were so stupid, they were so primitive, they didn't know how to explain things, so they came up with all these gods, and suddenly we all saw the light? No, they did see something. They saw explicit manifestations of Hashem's spirituality in the world. And therefore, they had to explain them. They explained them by attributing them to many gods. Once those were removed, those explicit forces are removed, then you have this idea of atheism in the world. Before that, you never had atheism. You had polytheism. But suddenly you have the growth of atheism and then rationalism. This all only emerges in history after God's explicit presence in the world is taken away. If you look in Rabbi Jeremy Kagan of Yerushalayim, says this in Source 8, in his book, The Jewish Self, the men of the Great Assembly witnessed this deliverance, talking about the Purim story. Mordechai, one of the main figures in the story, was a member of the Assembly. They were charged with writing the Book of Esther to record the event for history. They recognized that their principal responsibility was to communicate to the coming generations the change that had taken place in the way the Creator expressed himself in the world. He no longer intervened explicitly in events. Instead, he operated quietly through the machinery of nature. And how do they express this to the people? By writing a Megillah that does not have God's name in it, because there's no explicit God in the story. And why? Why do we have this change? The root cause which underlies all these changes is the abolition of the inclination in man to worship idols. So, what better time? So now we have a situation where there's no explicit presence of God in the world. What better time for Amalek to attack? Hey, there's no God in the world. This is what we've been saying all along. See, we're right all along. This is when Amalek comes in and attacks. And Bnei Israel bought into it. They were in a bad place, and they bought into this ideology. You know that because in the Megillah, Chazal tell us that what happened with Haman was a punishment for what Bnei Israel did in the beginning of the Megillah when they attended Ahasuerus's Seuda, his big banquet that they shouldn't have attended. But Bnei Israel, and Mordechai saw that connection. But Bnei Israel didn't see that connection. All they saw was a coincidence. They didn't see any connection between what they did and what happened. All one big coincidence. That this just, why did this Haman thing happen? Out of the blue. And that is, in a sense, the villain of Purim. The villain of Purim is seeing the story of Purim as a bunch of coincidences, when really it's all part of Hashem's Seder. It's all a string of events that Hashem laid out. The perfect example of this ideology, is it just coincidence or chance, or is it part of God's plan? And that's the Battle of Purim. And at the time, you could have seen it that way. You could have seen it as coincidences. We read the Megillah and everything happens boom, boom, boom. But there are years between the banquet and Haman's decree. Esther was in the castle for 5 some odd years before Haman's decree. So before the rest of the story, You could have seen it as a string of coincidences. You might not have seen the connection between Esther being made queen and what happened later on with Haman. And that's what Amalek would like you to see. That's the villain of the story, the ideology of just seeing it as chance. And you see that in the name of Purim. What does Purim come from? The poor. What's the poor? A lottery. How does Haman choose what day to attack the Jews? He chooses the lottery. What's the lottery? A game of chance. That's his ideology. Haman leaves everything up to chance, because that's how he lives his life. But what do we believe? We see the turnaround. We see v'nahapochu. It's not Purim. It's not about chance. It's all about a greater plan. This view of Amalek is antithetical to what we as Jewish people believe, and it's antithetical to Torah. Like we know from the Mishnah in Perkei Avot, from the first Mishnah in Perkei Avot, Torah is all about Seder. And that's what we accepted at Har Sinai. And that's also, that idea, at Har Sinai, we accepted that God created the world, and God controls the world, and God has a plan in the world. That's what we accepted at Har Sinai, and that's what we accepted and reaffirmed on Purim. We know that Purim was also a time of Matan Torah. If you look at the source 14, the Gemara in Shabbos, V'yitzvu b'tachtit ha'har, Amar Rav Avdimi bar Chama bar Chasa, Mlamid shekafa HaKadosh Baruch Hu aleihem et ha'har kegigit, V'amar lahem, im atem mekabulim ha'Torah, mutav, v'im lav, sham tehei kvuratchem. Quotes the pasuk that Bnei Israel were standing at the foot of the mountain. And Rav Avdimi bar Chama bar Chasa says, we learn from this that Hashem held the mountain over their heads like an upturned vat. He covered them. And Hashem said to them, if you accept the Torah, great, fantastic. If not, this will be your burial place, meaning the mountain's going to come down on top of you. Amar Rav Acha bar Yaakov, Mikan Modia Rabba lo Raite. Rav Acha bar Yaakov says, well, from here, there is grounds to say that the acceptance of Torah had an element of coercion involved, that Bnei Israel were coerced to it. Amar Rava, Rava says, Afal pi chein hador kiblua bimei achashverosh, dichtiv kimu vikiblu hayehudim, kimu masha kiblu kfar. In any case, even if this is true, the generation in the time of Achashverosh accepted the Torah, like it's written, kimu vikiblu, the Jews established and accepted. They established in the days of Achashverosh what they had already accepted in the days of Moshe. So there's a second Matan Torah, and that Matan Torah is at the end of a Purim story. After the miracle of Purim, the Jews reaffirm their belief in Torah. And what better time to do it? Because Purim is about reaffirming the belief that Hashem created the world, controls the world, and everything is part of Hashem's plan. And that's what you can see from the Purim story. And what better time to reaffirm that than after we've lost Hashem's explicit presence in the world? And we're saying, even though we don't always see it, even though we're not going to see it so clearly, we are still affirming that we believe that Hashem is controlling the world. That's why Purim is such an appropriate time to reaffirm Matan Torah, because the whole story and our belief in the miracle of Purim reaffirms the basic purpose and idea of Torah. So it's not a coincidence or by chance that Purim is the holiday where we reaffirm Torah. Now, Rebbe Leff of Moshav Matisyahu has a few interesting things to say that follow out of this idea. When a sofer writes a Torah, the Torah requires something called sirtut, that it should be pre-lined. The cloth, the parchment, is pre-lined, and then the sofer comes in and writes all the letters in. And the purpose of having it that way is to show that the letters and words of the Torah represent the unfolding of events in this world. So the line where the letter will be set represents the divine plan, that there's already a path there, and all that a path that's already predetermined by Hashem, and all we need to do is fill in the lines. Well, the Megillas generally don't require Sirtu. They can just be written, 4 out of the 5 Megillas can just be written on any piece of cloth and doesn't require this pre-lining. But the Purim Megillah, Megillah Esther, requires Sirtut. Also has to have these lines. Because the Purim Megillah, like the Torah, demonstrates to us that there is a predetermined plan. And that's our avoda on Purim, to reaffirm that we believe that Hashem controls the world, that there is a predetermined set of events. Now, we also know there's a certain emotion associated with the Purim holiday, and that's Simcha. Purim is supposed to be a time of Simcha. How do we get to that place? So Rabbi Lev says that it's a well-known idea in Judaism that Ein Simcha kehatarat Sfeikot. There is no greater joy in this world than resolving doubts. No greater happiness than resolving doubts. So if you believe, a Amalek, again, is doubt, but if you reject the ideology of a Amalek, if you believe that Hashem is controlling everything, then you have no reason to doubt yourself or to be afraid of what's going to be in your life, and then you can be the Simcha. And one more thing. We know Chayev Adam libsume ad shelo yada ben arhaman baruch Mordechai, that a person on Purim should get drunk to the point where they can't tell the difference between cursed is Haman, between the villain of the story, and Baruch Mordechai, the hero of the story. What does that mean? What's the connection? Because if you're in a difficult situation and you're willing to say that you have total emunah in Hashem and you're not going to have any doubts about your situation, then in a sense, you're letting go of control. And what's getting drunk? Getting drunk is, at its very base level, is letting go of control. You get drunk, you let go of control to the point where you don't know what's good from bad. And that's what we're asking you, that's what the Torah is asking us to do in the time of Purim, is to let go of control, to have total trust in Hashem and be secure even when you're in a state where you're not in control and where you can't tell good from bad. That when you're in a situation and you don't know what's right and what's wrong, and you don't know what's good and what's bad, if you have emunah in Hashem, then you can still be the Simcha even when you're in such a situation. So to recap, we asked about Mechiat Amalek, about what is this commandment to just wipe out a nation. And we answered that it's not so much wiping out a physical destruction, but about destroying an ideology, and the ideology that there is no reason in the world, that there's no God in the world, that there's no God that's controlling the world. We established by looking at the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that the Torah attests to the absolute opposite ideology, that we believe that Hashem did create the world, that there is purpose in the world, that nothing is coincidence or chance. We talked about how a Amalek strikes when Bnei Israel is on the path to doing good, and that our constant battle is to fight against the feelings of doubt in Hashem that a Amalek engenders. And that is the avoda of Purim. Purim is about seeing God's hand, seeing everything as a greater plan, and not as a string of coincidences. So I hope that this Purim we can all do the avoda of Purim and reaffirm our faith in Hashem and our faith in Torah. And I wish you a Purim that's filled with simcha, the kind of simcha that comes in a growth in emunah in Torah and a growth in emunah in Hashem. Thank you. I have a question. Yes. Okay, so she's asking if a Amalek is, in a sense, an internal concept within Bnei Israel, that that it's created by our doubt. Well, you could look at it two ways. You could say that we, in a sense, we create it. Which comes first? So a malik is the counterforce to what Bnei Israel bring to this world. The Jewish people introduced into the world the concept of monotheism, of belief in God. So when that of faith, and when Bnei Israel brought that in, there was a counterforce that was brought in. But yes, when a malik attacks, it's not always, it could be an external attack, it could be in an internal attack. So yeah, we are fighting that force externally, but we're also fighting it every day internally for us to look at the world and see that everything is part of Hashem's plan, even though everyone knows looking at the world today, that's very difficult sometimes. And that is the battle, and there is no greater time in the year to engage in that battle than Purim, than the holiday where we are so strongly affirming that we believe that everything's part of a plan. Think if you were living at the time of the Purim story. You know, things looked really bad, but then you see that it was part of a greater plan. And yes? Okay, so two questions. The first question was, isn't Judaism a questioning religion, in which case doubt would be a positive thing? And the second thing is just still finding the concept disturbing because other nations could, I think what you're saying is that other nations could basically frame us as their amalek.
Right, and they would say you are my amalek, so I'm
doing exactly what you would do to amalek. Okay, so in the first question, is doubt a good thing or not? There's different kinds of doubt. If you look at the language when Bnei Israel accepted the Torah, the parallel language to kimu v'kiblu is na'aseh v'nishma. We will do and we will listen. So we understand that to mean that the Jewish people were saying, we'll do first. We'll do first and then we'll listen. So when you're working within a framework where you're accepting the system, you're accepting the beliefs, and you're doing the action, that's when you can question. So that's very different than what a malik does, which is saying there's no order in the world. Their starting point is the doubt. They're saying there is no God. They're saying that there is no God running the world. What we're questioning is appropriate is where you're saying, I believe, but I don't understand some things. And you're looking to have that clarified so that you can grow in your observance. But the bottom line is, until that point, you're still doing. You're still doing. And that's the difference. Do you follow that?
No, I mentioned that, but I'm weak commanded. One time I heard that the first commandment, I am from your God. What's the commandment about that? Well, okay. What's the commandment? In the world, or that he does.
Because you have a commandment to believe. You have a commandment to believe. And if you're working from a frame point that you accept that, then you can question. But a malik isn't working on that framework. A malik doesn't want to believe. A malik is the active force of saying, we won't believe. And as for your second question, that's a very difficult question to answer. But what I've been trying to show here is that we're not talking about a physical destruction. You're talking about destroying an ideology. So we don't know who a malik is today, if there is even a physical concept of a malik. A malik's an ideology you're trying to rid from the world. It's not about a physical battle.
But if you knew, that would
I don't. I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know. I mean, there's a number of Gemaras about a malik, which just say that there is no concept of the nations anymore. That this concept doesn't exist. And as for what other people have done, whatever Bnei Israel do to are within a certain order, and again, they're offered a peaceful settlement, all they have to do is accept that God exists. That's all what is being asked of them.
Say all they have to do, but except it's
Not anywhere in the world, only within Israel, where they'd be surrounding the Jewish people. They're offered many alternatives. But this is a different question. You're asking questions about what was happening thousands of years ago. The bottom line is, as far as we frame the battle today, it's an ideological battle that we're fighting within ourselves and within the ideologies of the world around us, where there is a very strong ideology of doubt in the world today. Are there any other questions? Thank you all. Have a happy term.